It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
The president tonight signing an executive order calling on federal regulators to review a law that shields social media companies from being responsible for what people post on their sites.
They have a shield. They can do what they want. They have a shield. They're not going to have that shield.
President Trump still fuming about Twitter slapping a fact-check label on a pair of his tweets where he claimed mail-in ballots would be substantially fraudulent. But there's no evidence of widespread fraud in mail-in voting. Still, the president's accusing the tech companies of trying to stifle conservative voices, insisting they want to censor in advance of the 2020 election.
What they choose to fact check and what they choose to ignore or even promote is nothing more than a political activism group or political activism.
While the government cannot restrict free speech, private companies can set whatever rules they like.
It's a really important thing to do, thoughtful, important legislation, and this is not the way to do it. It's slapdash, it's angry, it's belligerent, it's punitive, and it is not policy.
Meantime, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg is today criticizing Twitter.
We have a different policy, I think, than Twitter on this. You know, I just believe strongly that Facebook shouldn't be the arbiter of truth of everything that people say online.
Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey saying his site's not an arbiter of truth, but that its intention is to show information in dispute so people can judge for themselves.
All right, that was an NBC report recently about something that I don't have to prove to you. You know that the big tech companies are censoring certainly our speech, conservative speech. They censor the things we're able to send to each other. They are censoring who we can listen to, what we can hear, and it's getting worse and worse. And so what do we do about this? Well, the show today is going to be talking about that. We're going to talk about what was alluded to in that opening story about a presidential executive order, and we will get to that in a few minutes. But there are some things that perhaps you and I could do as well. And that's why I've asked Liz Scheld, who's the senior editor of American Greatness, to join us this morning, because she's a tech giant herself, in the sense that she understands the tech world so well. And I've asked her to join us to help us out here. Liz, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Sandy.
Hey, you know what? In your own, how bad do you think censorship is right now? We're all seeing it, but how bad is it?
I think it's bad, and I think it's going to get worse, right? We've seen this, especially Twitter, really tightening the reins on explicitly, right? In the past, a lot of complaints about Twitter were that people were being shadow banned, which meant that they didn't seem to be banned to the user. It looked like they were just tweeting and it was going out and everything was fine, but no one was seeing them. But I think with the move to actually label the president's tweet, sort of putting up a warning flag, suggests to me that they're getting bolder and it's only going to get worse closer to the election. So I think it's going to get worse. I do think Zuckerberg has publicly taken the right position about not being the one to decide, you know, what is true or false, especially in a political ad where, I mean, let's be honest, how many political ads are misleading and boastful? All of them. That's kind of what they're marketing. It's like, do you check the advertising for different products that promise that your nails will grow long and your hair and your wrinkles will disappear? No, we know that that's marketing. So I do applaud Zuckerberg for taking that public stance, but there have been issues with him censoring certain advertisements and certain phrases or words on Facebook. So I think we are in a time now where we have to act. You know, we have to make some decisions that are more than just us going on these platforms and saying, hey, why are you censoring? I don't like censoring. Your company's bad. what really these companies understand is when you take you leave, you go off of them, you use something else, or if they have competition, because remember, they don't have any competition right now. So, you know, I think it's time to move, time to act.
Well, here's the thing. You know as well as I know that, you know, here I've had this same personal email account for, well, lots of years, and that's how people get in touch with me. That's how professional people know how to find me. That's kind of like my trademark. How in the world can I, like, switch to another platform, Liz? I mean, that would be almost professional suicide, or even losing touch with longtime old friends. What should a person do about, just for instance, their email?
Right. And, you know, someone like you, that you have a high profile brand, you have a large following, you have a lot of fans, you don't just want to disappear. So I wouldn't suggest that people just completely get off of these other platforms. What I suggest is that people also use these the competition, let's say, that are largely unknown. People don't know about them. And so the best thing you can do is keep your following, keep your audiences on these platforms, while at the same time lifting up these lesser known outlets that are more free speech oriented, and the more and tell people about it. And as they grow and raise their visibility, it'll be easier to make that full transition, right? I mean, the most dangerous thing for Facebook and Twitter that have a monopoly on and YouTube, which is notorious, and that's Google. YouTube is Google. Is that they don't have any competition. They can do whatever they want because, again, like you said, where else are you going to go? Well, we have to start building this escape hatch. We have to start building up these other places. So I would not say abandon it. I would say start spreading yourself around a little more and do word of mouth. That's what helps these places grow.
And I heard, you know, I heard you say this last week in another meeting. Liz, and I thought it was brilliant, and I want to just kind of expand on that for a second. So what you're saying is, okay, so don't give up your email account. Don't leave Facebook. Don't leave Twitter. Add to that same kind of platform, add another thing or two things, and build your audience, kind of pull your audience, your friendships, pull your friendships or whoever, your contacts, over to that platform as you do like a two-legged thing for a while, or a three-legged thing. And so that when you are completely cut off, which we will be when information is finally not able to be had, if it continues the way it is, you will be ready with a different platform that is friendly to free speech. That's basically what you're saying, right?
Absolutely. And that includes when you are looking for a video to send someone, go see if it's on BitChute instead of YouTube. BitChute, which is BitChute, BitChute. See if it's there. Send someone a link to BitChute instead of YouTube. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, Liz, hang on. Let's sit on that for just a second, because I, you know, a lot of those videos, for instance, it is past tense to me, the coronavirus scandals,
right,
hoax, a lot of the videos by doctors on the West Coast, by that Mikovits, who was the former scientist, but was countering Dr. Fauci. Those things were taken down from YouTube, but you could still find them at BitChute. And so That's the point here. You know, start like
exactly.
If you do videos with your organization or you use that as a platform, can people take videos and then put them? Can embed them in BitChute?
Absolutely. Yes, you can. You can do your own thing. Like if you're on YouTube and you have, you know, a small following, or even if you're a big star, put your video on YouTube and then put it on BitChute also. And when you send out an email to tell your friends, hey, I have some new content, say, you can watch me on YouTube and you can also watch me on BitChute. Because really, it's a process of normalizing these alternatives venues, because there was a time when I was like, Twitter, what's that? Remember years ago?
Yes,
Facebook,
I do remember.
What's that?
Yep.
Or Instagram. These were, at some point, they were all new and you heard about it. And so it's kind of our responsibility to let other people hear about it by what we choose to do with our time. Because really, what are these platforms other than our content? They don't produce anything themselves. They don't make anything. They are us. They're the contributors. So So that's the value, is the value is us. So spread it around to other people who are honestly more worthy of your efforts and your attention.
Yeah, so we're helping them, and we're also setting, putting a kind of a an escape hatch for ourselves when things get really bad. And now Twitter, there's an let's talk about these alternatives. What's an alternative to Twitter?
So the alternative to Twitter is Parler, and that's spelled P-A-R-L-E-R. And it's very similar to the Twitter style, short, pithy statements. They sort of have a retweet function. It's not called retweet, obviously, because that's the Twitter thing. But it's the same principle. You can follow people. You can comment. And it's the same thing. And they don't censor their content. They assume that their readers are grown-ups and can make a decision about whether they want to follow someone or whether they want to believe something that they read.
Excellent. Okay, so how about Facebook? Is there an alternative to Facebook? I know that there is, actually. I tried to sign up for one, but the problem was, Liz, again, the thing is, I don't do Facebook much, but I have my radio show has a big following on Facebook. So I can't just stop doing Facebook because this platform didn't have anyone on it yet. But now you're saying add that to your list. Move your audience over there gradually.
Yeah, just put it up over there, and when you send an email, you know, in your signature, a lot of people would say, follow me on Twitter, or follow me on Instagram, follow me on Facebook. Put in follow me on Minds. It's Minds.com, M-I-N-D-S. Follow me on Minds. Add that in there so people are like, oh, what's this? And, you know, you're introducing it. We're helping lift up these places that are committed to the same principles of free speech that we are.
Are there any other, besides, now we talked about Parler, Minds, BitChute, is there anything else that, any other alternative that you would recommend for any of these, Instagram or, you know, what else is out there? Are those the three main ones you want to talk to us about?
Those are the three main ones that sort of fit to the three main, you know, outlets that we're used to, kind of as political people, you know, where we get a lot of news and information. I'm sure there are other ones, and I'll definitely be investigating that and send that along to you so you can share with your listeners. But everybody should be on the lookout for alternatives, because one day we're going to get unplugged entirely. And the question is, where are we going to go? Well, we don't want to find ourselves completely lost and alone. So it's just critical that we start lifting up these other places. And
well,
I have
it's
no
happened.
Relationship with them. You know, I don't own them. I don't have any. I'm just a user like everybody else.
Yeah, and you know, people have already been canceled from these platforms. InfoWars, just comes to my mind. I don't remember who else, but Candace Owen. A lot of people have been completely removed, so that they did, like they were in no man's land, and some of them are probably still there. So we're talking about well-known people, but it also applies to each of you listening. To your sphere of influence, and for, you know, for instance, from my way of communicating with those of you that listen, also the other platforms that you use, this is just a very smart thing to do, and that's why I wanted Liz to tell us about it. Liz, there are other things going on. We just have a minute so left here. There are other things going on, though, among techies to try to sort of counter this free speech, like that anti-censorship technology. Can you just say a word about that?
The anti-censorship technology?
Well, yes, you know, like altering metadata and things like that. I mean, I can't even understand it, but understand it.
Yeah, people are definitely trying, because the tech companies and also ad networks are so closely intertwined, because that is how these tech companies make their money, off selling your data and your reading habits and your clicking habits data to marketers to then put ads on their site. There are a couple places that obscure your metadata that makes it hard for you to track. Off the top of my head, I'd have to go look up to what they are. And it is possible to just keep confusing it to make you untrackable.
I think the point I wanted to make just was that there are other efforts going on that we probably can't handle because we're not technical, you know, not like that. But there are efforts to try to counter this, and I wanted people to know that. Liz Schell, Senior Editor of American Greatness. Liz, thank you so much. We appreciate your time this morning. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
And I have to say that these days, I'm not merely worried about my ability to do that and my fellow patriots to be able to do that. I'm terrified. I've witnessed friends and allies stripped of their platforms and their reputations and their voices. Some can no longer communicate on social media. When I planted my little flag in the social media world on the internet almost 20 years ago, I never thought that I'd have to wake up one day and wonder if my entire website was going to be unplugged because of an opinion that I expressed. And yet, there are many of my friends and allies, your compatriots, who not only can no longer communicate on social media, on Twitter, on Facebook, or Instagram, but who also can no longer gather peacefully at hotel conferences to discuss their ideas. Still others are now forbidden from doing business with their banks, their payment processors, online retailers, and even ride-sharing services. There is no more safe space that we can feel that we are guaranteed the right to communicate our ideas with each other, not in restaurants, not at homes. And you've seen over the last couple of years since Donald Trump took office that there are many elected officials in Washington, D.C., who can no longer walk on the streets without a threat or risk of violence to themselves or their families.
That was Michelle Malkin making a speech recently, and of course she's describing very graphically and emotionally what a lot of people are experiencing. Some have just been, as they say, canceled. Like, I guess it'd be the equivalent of killing someone if you cancel them. Something like that. It's a little dramatic, but honestly, if you cannot, if your words cannot be heard, you cannot be seen, if nothing that you think can be shared, if you're cut off from friends and family and communications because of your opinions about certain issues, it's a very serious matter. And some are actually, you know, they're being doxxed, what's called doxing, where they reveal your private address. This is happening to policemen right now around the country, where they're revealing personal details about them and their families. It's very frightening. And the power of big tech companies and the wicked people who use them for their wicked purposes is becoming more and more dangerous. Rachel Bovard is with us this morning. Rachel is the Senior Director of Policy at the Conservative Partnership Institute. That's former Senator Jim DeMint's organization. And Rachel is just a wealth of knowledge on so many issues, but she's written a tremendous amount about big tech. And I've asked her to join us this morning for this conversation. Rachel, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So Michelle has been around for a long time, and she's right. She was one of the first pundits to actually use social media very cleverly. Now it seems so quaint, so very long ago. But things have changed, Rachel, and I thought it would be good for us to start with kind of recent examples. Heaven knows we've had enough problems in the last month that we could write a book. But what are some kind of examples that come to your mind about how big tech has used their power of censorship to affect what's happening really worldwide, but let's talk about here in the United States? Coronavirus, let's start with that. You've wrote a whole article about that. What are they doing with that?
Yeah, this was a particularly active time for big tech. And, you know, we saw examples of censorship during the coronavirus pandemic. Not only was Facebook taking down protest organization content. So anyone trying to organize a protest, an anti-lockdown protest, Facebook removed that content. And they did so because they said, well, some states, you know, it violates their social distancing guidance, so, you know, we're going to take it down. And what I found that was particularly stunning about that is that the right to organize and the right to speech is constitutionally protected outside of Facebook. But now you have Facebook essentially acting as an arm of the government and saying, we are going to shut down your speech because we can. Otherwise, it's constitutionally protected, but Facebook is now going to act as an arm of the government, and the government can use Facebook as a private company to enforce what might be, you know, a constitutional violation of speech.
Yes,
so that was one example.
Yeah, it was a big example. And then, of course, we had I think, YouTube. In fact, I will play this
Correct.
Clip. This will bring you, this all just, this was the CEO of YouTube, who during the coronavirus, I speak of it as though it were past tense because I actually think it is, even though we're pretending like it isn't. But this is clip 11. Let's hear the YouTube CEO admitting that they're removing video that go against World Health Organization policy. Let's listen.
But then we also talk about removing information that is problematic. You know, of course, anything that is medically unsubstantiated, so people saying like, take vitamin C, take turmeric, like those are all will cure you. Those are the examples of things that would be a violation of our policy. Anything that would go against World Health Organization recommendations would be a violation of our policy. And so remove is another really important part of our policy.
You know, Rachel, I just, as she says that, I can't believe she admitted it. It makes one think, with all of these companies, how is it physically possible to vet every post, every, you know, video that someone, how is that even possible? Is it artificial intelligence?
It's not. And that's why, you know, YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, they pick winners and losers. They pick the speech they like. You know, for instance, Twitter fact checks President Trump, but doesn't fact check, you know, Iranian dictatorship threatening violence against Jews. So they allow that to go on their platform, but they don't allow President Trump to make accurate claims about voter fraud. So this is something, you know, they cannot police everyone. So they clearly pick who to police based on their political viewpoint. And that, you know, the more they control the public square and the means of debate and what we see in the information that we get, that has a huge impact, not just on our speech, but on our behavior, how we vote in elections. Because it, more and more of these companies are the public square and they're enforcing one political viewpoint above others.
We should also say, to give a little background on this, the acceleration of this happened probably midnight on the election day of 2016. When President Trump won, that's when tech companies started getting huge blowback from the left about, you know, how could they allow this to happen? And so don't you think, Rachel? I mean, that seems to me like the starting point of all this censorship on steroids. Your thoughts about that?
No, that's right. You know, nobody likes big tech right now. The right doesn't like them, and the left certainly doesn't like them. And the left wants them to do more on this censorship side of things. And what's really stunning is that you saw the COO of Facebook admit at the beginning of this year in a leaked memo, it was a memo he sent internally but leaked to the New York Times, he said, yes, we won President Trump the election because President Trump ran the best ad campaign I've ever seen on our Facebook platform, which there's nothing wrong with that. Campaigns should be able to do that. But what he said next was, we have the power to take that away from him. We have the power to swing elections. Now, we should never do it, but we have that power. And I think that's just a stunning admission from a private company that they effectively can swing elections one way or the other. I think that should get everybody's attention because these companies have grown so powerful that they now have control over sort of our democratic process. I think lawmakers should wake up to that and say, hold on a second, this is not, you know, what we signed up for. A private corporation can be a threat to liberty just as much as the government in this case.
That reminds me of the hearings with Dr. Robert Epstein, who I can't give his credentials, but he did a lot of research on the impact. He's a Democrat, by the way, did a lot of research on the bias of Google in election 2016. And he made the claim that Google could actually sway millions of voters and that they will do that in the future. How could Google sway millions of voters? How would they do that, Rachel?
So this is a fascinating topic. And, you know, in addition to the work that Dr. Epstein has done, the Wall Street Journal last year did a very deep investigation into Google's algorithms because they say they give you neutral search results, but they very much do not. And their investigation revealed that, you know, Google will tweak an algorithm in favor of big business, or they will suppress the search results that you get for terms like immigration or abortion. And very much Google is open to lobbying from certain interests. The Wall Street Journal found that, you know, Google changed its search results for abortion based on lobbying from Planned Parenthood. And when 90% of the world uses Google for search, which is their user base is that big, this decision by a private company has ripple effects across the globe and across our democracy. Because if you think you're getting a neutral search result, when in fact you are getting one curated for you by the leftists at Google, that is going to change, you know, what you think about the world and how you may vote. So it is a very, very serious issue and has huge ramifications, you know, not just for our elections, but again, our behavior, our privacy, how we act in the world, all of this by the strings pulled at Google.
Well, and actually, what I think one way to understand this is with Google and with the others, they control the way you think as much by what you can't see as what they make sure you do see. So you don't hear a counter narrative. You're just hearing,
right.
You know, which is especially what we're seeing right now. In fact, this is an international story, but you probably saw this, Rachel, but just this week, actually, Google had what they call a glitch. And it happened to coincide when Black Lives Matter protesters were in Trafalgar Square, and they were defacing Winston Churchill's statue. Now, Winston Churchill, of course, was the Prime Minister of Great Britain. I have to explain that because we don't learn that in public schools. And he led Britain through World War II. He was a great hero. But they say on this, he was a racist. That's what Black Lives Matter has written in London. And at the same time, when you would Google Winston Churchill, suddenly the image of Winston Churchill was not there. And instead it, I don't know if you know the story. I should let you tell it if you do know the story. They just had an avatar instead of his picture. And when you actually, you know, Googled him as a prime minister, they didn't give the full dates of his leadership. And they gave some excuse about, oh, it was just a glitch, momentarily gone. But this is Winston Churchill. He was the, you know, the voice of World War II who got Britain through the war. And I think probably a lot of Americans, too. That's the kind of power that they have, Rachel. That's very dangerous. It gives kids and people who are not educated a distorted view of the world and of history.
They are exactly right, and Google has done this on numerous occasions. You know, they set up, if you Google, you know, entrepreneurs, they make sure that, you know, historically entrepreneurs, because of the social situation at the time, were white men. But Google doesn't want you to see that. So they will put other entrepreneurs, you know, maybe hide Thomas Edison and put up, you know, a person of color because they want people to see a diverse platform. Now, again, that's Google's decision, right? They're a private company. But when 90% of the world uses Google, Google is creating a culture in its own image. Again, you know, and they're unaccountable in doing so because we don't elect Google. We can't unelect the head of Google. And so I do think that there really is, you know, public policymakers, I think, need to be taking a second look at these big tech companies, because they are private companies, but they are changing our social order, and they are changing the way we live and how we behave and who we elect and what privacy means in this country. And this is a conversation, I think, that really needs to be taking place that I don't see taking place right now in Congress.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. When those hearings took place, I guess last year, maybe year before, the time is so strange right now. It's like one day is like 1,000 years, honestly. The Senate, especially, they had no knowledge of technology. And the senators, you know, would read these statements from their young staffers, and they really ended up, to me, besides Ted Cruz and maybe a few others, making fools of themselves. They are not capable, really, of handling, at least right now, this current personnel that serves there is just not capable of making complex decisions about how to handle this problem. And we're going to get to the resolution in just a second on the other side of the break, Rachel, or one of the solutions. But I do want to ask you, in the 2 minutes that we have left here, we touched on, without saying it, China's influence in this. The World Health Organization is controlled by China, and YouTube, the CEO, just said in our soundbite that they would not allow anything about COVID on their platform that was not sanctioned by the World Health Organization. But China has influence in other ways, too. I think that's part of the genesis of this, don't you?
Absolutely. You know, China very much controls big tech in the sense that they're a big market, right? So you've seen Google actively build censorship regimes on behalf of the Chinese government. You've seen Apple remove apps that were being used by the Hong Kong protesters when they were literally on the streets fighting for their freedom. Apple just took away their tools because the Chinese government told them to. So China very much infiltrates these platforms. You saw Twitter censor and YouTube censor on behalf of the Chinese government. If people were critiquing China, their posts got removed immediately. So there's a big problem, you know, an accountability problem with big tech in China that has largely gone unexplored. You know, we have a lot of examples of it, but no one really holding their feet to the fire about it.
So we have China, who is, you know, they're a communist country. They don't even, free speech is the furthest thing they want. They are totalitarian in every way, and they don't want free thought or free ideas. And so now we're moving to their model rather than our own free speech model. Mm-hmm. Then you have the Europeans and their hate speech codes. Say a word about that, Rachel.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. You know, they just do not, free speech doesn't mean anything to them. And so why are we taking cues from China? Why are we making our platforms responsive to them? That's a big question that I think has largely been unanswered. Again, these corporations are unaccountable for their behavior. We have no way to hold them to account. Sure, we can go use other platforms, but right now there is no near-term competitor to Facebook, to Twitter. And if you're someone like me who publishes, you know, frequently, who tries to shape the national debate on these questions, I have to be where the people are. So I have to stay on Twitter and be subject to sort of its political bias and its censorship. And I don't really have, you know, another option with a host of people. So
which I should
question.
I should drop in. You know, we just talked with Liz Sheldon. She's suggesting Parler. You know this. Parler, I'm not saying, right. I'm telling this to you, Rachel, because you know. Parler is another outlet similar to Twitter. And for those of you that use Twitter, it's time to kind of double up and use both platforms until we make the transition. Rachel's going to stay with me because we're going to talk about a solution coming out of the White House. Stay tuned.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the Morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Today I'm signing an executive order to protect and uphold the free speech and rights of the American people. Currently, social media giants like Twitter receive an unprecedented liability shield based on the theory that they're a neutral platform. My executive order calls for new regulations under Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act to make it that social media companies that engage in censoring or any political conduct will not be able to keep their liability shield.
All right, that's the President of the United States, and he's touching on something that I want to talk with Rachel about now. Rachel, again, is the Senior Director of Policy for the Conservative Partnership, and this is a solution that people have been calling for. It's very controversial, but Rachel, it has to do with something that was passed, what, in 1996? It was a Communications Act that's still in place. Explain what that act provided for and why these companies are protected right now in their ability to censor all of us freely.
So President Trump's executive order deals with Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which, as you point out, was passed in 1996 before any of these companies even existed, before the modern internet really is what it is today. And basically it did two things. It said internet companies, you know, and websites will not be considered publishers. That is number one. And the number two is that they will not be held liable for any content they remove as sort of a good Samaritan provision. And the goal, as one of the drafters said, Chris Cox, a Republican congressman at the time, said, we want to use this to clean up the internet. We want to incentivize companies to take down, you know, the sort of smut and nastiness that flourishes online without being held liable for it. And that's a good thing. You know, in many ways, Section 230 sort of allowed the internet to grow. It, you know, didn't allow these companies to be sued out of existence, but it has since become judicially manipulated. It has been interpreted by the courts to be this bulletproof immunity that, you know, basically allows big tech to do whatever it wants, and it's not held liable for any sort of decision it makes to take any kind of content down. And so President Trump put forth an executive order that basically said, look, we want to interpret Section 230 how we think it was originally written, which is to say, if these companies enforce a political viewpoint, they will lose this liability shield that they have, and they will, you know, open themselves up to lawsuits. And this is a huge deal because these companies profit off of Section 230. It's what makes them different from a newspaper, right? And so his executive order petitions, because he can't direct the Federal Communications Organization and the NCIA, he has to petition them because they're independent agencies to put forth regulations to this effect. And so that's what the gist of his executive order. It gets at that censorship that a lot of people see from big tech. I assume it will be challenged in court, but he's put it forward and we're waiting for this to see if the agencies will respond to it.
So it is an executive order. It's not a law, as you just described, and it can be challenged, of course. But my surprise is, Rachel, is that in this current climate, a lot of even conservatives object to what he's trying to do. Why? What is their objection?
So they object to the fact that he is sort of reinterpreting the law. They feel that is not the appropriate role for the White House, that the administration, the executive should leave that to Congress. And it's a gray area, right? This is distinct from what President Obama used to do, which is just to create law out of thin air and put it in an executive order. I think you can argue that the president's role is to enforce the law, and he's enforcing Section 230 as he sees fit. But again, you know, it'll be challenged in court. However, I do think that there's a political aspect to this that I think people underestimate, which is that, you know, a lot of times President Trump, he is a political animal. He basically made Section 230 a congressional issue. A lot of people didn't know what it was before. And as a result of this executive order, people are now saying, hey, Congress, you should do something about this. And I think that is a sea change in how this is being handled. It's forcing Congress a little bit to have a position to deal with an issue that they probably weren't going to deal with otherwise. And so the executive order, I think, will actually push Congress to act. And I think that's a good thing.
Okay, so Rachel, I'm sorry, I'm unclear. So I'm going to ask you again. This executive order then is setting in motion the instruction to the agencies to actually, what, reinterpret Section 230?
Correct. To issue regulations.
Okay.
Keeping with how the executive order lays out Section 230 as how the president sees it should be interpreted.
Okay. So it actually could do something. The tech companies, what has been their response to this?
So they are scared to death. because this is an existential threat to their business model. Again, these companies benefit from this government law, right? There's this misnomer, I think, that the government isn't involved with big tech, that these are private companies that exist apart from the government. That is false. They exist because of Section 230. They exist because of this sweetheart deal that they get from the government, which says you are immune from liability. You can pretty much act with impunity. No one can sue you. This is a special... one law professor called it an implicit financial subsidy. So,
right, so
they are now terrified that this will be taken away.
Wow. You know, they have become so big, and I think of Google. They're all international now, but Google seems to be the big dog. I think of they're pretty pride-filled now. To me, we've met with them several times, their executives. I can't imagine them being terrified. So that's interesting to see them scared. That is very interesting. You also at the same time have an antitrust suit being filed by, I believe, attorneys general. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so Section 230 is not the only way people are dealing with big tech. Google is currently under investigation by 50 states' attorneys general. And so to emphasize that point, you have Texas and New York both agreeing that Google has an antitrust claim against it, which is pretty shocking.
That is shocking.
So they are under investigation by the state AGs, but they're also under antitrust investigation by the Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission and Congress. Congress is also taking a look at big tech from an antitrust perspective. So, you know, there's, I think, an interest here in saying, you know, maybe if there was antitrust enforcement, not necessarily breaking the companies up, but on separate questions, you know, if we could reduce their power, we could compete a lot of these concerns away. We could compete away the privacy concerns. We could compete away the speech concerns. But if there's not a free market in tech, then we can't do that. And so that's really sort of a central question that antitrust investigators are looking at.
Rachel, we talked about, I think we should also expand our discussion a little bit. We're talking about censorship, and that's scary enough. We talk about how they control our being able to advertise, that we're going to meet certain places. That goes for political candidates, too. They have censored in the past. You know, they've taken candidates' Facebook pages down because they didn't, you know, there's some abuse of Facebook's policy. They think of reasons. Now, that's just Facebook, but there are other situations, too. But they have control in so many ways, like our financial data. Michelle Malkin in that soundbite we played earlier mentioned to that. Even our banking abilities or our abilities to pay online have been affected by their power, right?
Oh, yes. They, you know, are across the web. There's this notion, I think, that, you know, and maybe 10 years ago this was true, that you could simply opt out of Google. If you don't like Google, just don't use Google. don't use Facebook. That's just not true anymore. They are embedded across the web. So even if you're not using Google search or you're not on Facebook, these companies are tracking you and they have embeds across the web. Facebook was trying to get into the banking industry not that long ago. They want your financial data. And again, all of this is just money-making for them. They collect data on you across the web because that's how they make money. They sell targeted advertising based on your data. And so, of course, they want to expand into as many avenues as possible because it's a money-making institution for them.
But how do we counter that? Because the thing we're talking about, the executive order, has nothing to do with that part of it, does it? And is there anything in the works to sort of address the whole loss of privacy and the ability to protect any of us from, you know, abuse, from being doxxed, from all of the things, our personal medical information, all of it? Is there anything underway to push back on that?
Yeah, so it's a really good point that, you know, there's no silver bullet to tap. There's so many aspects of this debate that we have to deal with. And privacy is a big deal. And, you know, there is no federal privacy legislation when it comes to your data. There is just a void in that space. And so you're seeing some lawmakers say, hey, maybe my data should be my property. Maybe I should have a property right to the data, so I should be able to take it away from Facebook if I want. Because right now, consider, Facebook could deplatform you. They could take, you know, block your account, and they keep all of your data. They keep your pictures, they keep your videos, they keep your content, because it makes them money, but you get nothing in exchange. And so should your data be your property? And if your data was your property, could you just take it to another platform? Would that force more competition into the marketplace? So you're seeing people like Warren Davidson, a congressman from Ohio, Freedom Caucus member, talk about this question and potentially introduce legislation on it. And I think this is a really a big area for conservatives who care a lot about privacy and don't necessarily want tech to have all this information.
It is pretty scary. And in fact, just a practical question. You know, when you try to download an app of some sort, or if you subscribe to any sort of the Google services or the Facebook services, they want permission to access all of your contacts, all of your photos, all of your videos, as you just described. And really, many of them, there used to be an option that you didn't have to do that. But now, many times, you can't even use their services at all if you don't comply. Do they access it anyway? Are they able to access that stuff without your permission?
Well, that's, I think, the biggest question. And it goes to the fact that these companies are really unaccountable. Google is a serial liar with what it says it does, or it'll say it doesn't do it something, and then it does. For instance, Google tells you that if you turn off your location tracking on your Android phone, which is a Google phone, that they are not tracking your location. Well, it came out in a congressional hearing that, in fact, they are. And Google says, you know, oh, we don't keep this data on you forever. You can erase it. Well, you cannot, actually. Google still has your data. So it's really unclear, to be honest, what these companies are actually doing, because they have no problem sort of shading the truth. And in that sense, there is no meaningful consent. And because, you know, they're really aren't any near-term competitors, we're sort of forced to go along with it. But we don't really actually know what these companies are doing with your data because they don't have to tell you.
Now, one of the things that concerns me, Rachel, is I have seen with my own eyes, I guess I won't name names yet, but I have seen the influence of Facebook and Google in Washington, D.C. They both have, as you know, huge headquarters, very impressive, just really impressive, both of them. But it's not only that, they spread their money pretty broadly and have made a concerted effort in the last few years to bring in, I guess it's more than a few years, to sort of ingratiate themselves to conservative groups. And that really, really concerns me. And even inside the White House, I know that there are big fans of Google execs. I hear a lot of defense of, this is Google I'm talking about, I hear a lot of defense of them, and that really concerns me. I'd love to know what you think about all of that.
Yeah, you know, like any big private companies, you know, Google and Facebook and Twitter, they have massive lobbying influence. I think, you know, Facebook and Google are some of the biggest spenders in Washington on lobbying efforts. And if you consider how much money is spent on lobbying in Washington, that is significant, the fact that they spend the most. You know, and they do, they've funded a lot of conservative groups, Google has, and they fund a lot of left leaning groups as well. They've been sort of equal opportunity about it. But they do have a very significant presence on Capitol Hill in the conservative movement. And, you know, I think that they expect a lot of conservatives to sort of go along with their interests. And if you don't, it's not always a comfortable position to be in. So, I am trying to raise the alarm for conservatives that, you know, we do need to pay a little bit more attention to the growing power of these companies over what we say we care about, which is small business, our culture, our free elections, and our free markets. I think tech plays into all of this. And so, you know, even though I think Facebook and Google are pretty well ingratiated into the conservative movement, I think it's time we start asking them some hard questions.
Absolutely. I think the hard questions have been asked, but I don't see it among our leaders. I see some exceptions, Josh Hawley, Ted Cruz, maybe there, and the congressman you just mentioned in the Freedom Caucus, and I know there are others, but not many who are really pushing back on this. I'm curious, very quickly, Rachel, is Google able to actually contribute to parties, political parties?
Yes, Google can make campaign donations.
Yeah, okay, so that makes it even more complicated than we've already described. But meanwhile, the president is doing some really good things by this executive order on preventing online censorship. And by the way, it wouldn't be a bad idea for you to call the White House and praise him for that and praise them for doing that. It's an executive order on preventing online citizenship. We'll put information from Rachel on our Facebook page so that you can read and have the words to share. Rachel, thank you so much. Sandy Rios in the morning.